There's too much information for evolution to be true. Stay tuned to find out what I mean on Unapologetic. Now, you might be thinking, aren't there like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of studies that show that evolution is true? Well, that all depends on several things. The first might be, what do you mean by evolution? Anytime we talk about this topic, we need to define our terms here. I was just having a conversation this last Sunday after small group with a PhD student that's in my small group, and we were talking about evolution, and we actually disagree on some things, but some of that is just related to the fact that we use the term in different ways at points. And many people do today. And in fact, this guy and I, we have pretty much the same perspective on the issue, the same biblical worldview, and yet we use the term differently at points. And it's the same way with Christians and non-Christians. We need to define our terms. Because evolution, at least one usage of the term, just simply means change over time. And then we could take that a little further, and sometimes people will use it to refer to small, successive changes over time. And we might call that microevolution. And then others will use it, and what they're referring to is a mechanism that's able to generate a change in kinds over time. And we would call that macroevolution. That's pretty much the most common usage of the term today. This idea that life came about from a single-celled organism that over time reproduced more and more and more and became sufficiently more and more complicated through the twin mechanisms of natural selection and random mutation. So, as the genetic code is copied more and more as organisms reproduce, mutations occur, changes in that genetic code that are unintentional, they just are a natural byproduct of this reproductive process, and the changes that help the organism survive that are more beneficial for its adaptation and its survivability, well, those get selected for, quote unquote, and those organisms survive more, so they're more likely to pass on those helpful genetic changes. That's natural selection. So random mutation, changes in genetic code over time, plus natural selection, the idea that more helpful changes are more likely to be passed on and survive, well, you end up with the evolutionary idea that's most common today. This has also been called the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, the ideas of Darwin that have kind of been improved on and changed over time. So, that's the most common usage, but there are some usages even in between these, where some people might believe that evolution, this idea that random mutation and natural selection actually works, they might see that that fits with an idea that God created life. And not that he used evolution to do it, even. He may have created Adam and Eve as real people, which is my view. But then some people would say, well, once he created life, the diversity we see in life is actually a result of random mutation and natural selection. And that's not the view that's most common in secular institutions today, but that is a view of evolution. And it is a valid usage of that term, but all of this goes to show that we need to define our terms. Now, when I talk about evolution, by and large, and in the rest of this episode, I'm going to be referring to that totally naturalistic, unguided process that you're most likely to hear about in a university biology department. The Neo-Darwinian synthesis, that life started as a single-celled organism and over time, through random mutation and natural selection, became as complicated as it is today with human beings and the great diversity we see. Now, I started out this episode by saying there's too much information for evolution to be true. And here's what I mean by that. I don't mean that there are studies or aren't studies. What I mean is that our DNA, our genetic code, is actually information. And information is the product of a mind. So information is what's conveyed by a certain structure or sequence of data or things. And that's actually what genetic code is. Genetic code is information. It's a structured sequence that actually codes for the things it produces. But here's the kicker. Information is the product of minds, of a mind. So, for instance, if you were just walking through the woods and you saw a bunch of pine cones on each other, and they're not structured and anything like that, it just looks like they fell out of a tree, that's not information. But if, on the other hand, you see one pine cone, and then two pine cones, and then three pine cones, and a group of four pine cones, and then a group of five pine cones, what you have seen is a structured sort of thing. It's information, and that's the product of a mind. the chances of you walking through the wilderness and finding progressively stacked numbers of pine cones together is incredibly rare. It is much more likely that that's the product of a mind. And we actually see that same type of thing with the natural world. And in fact, Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, starts out by saying that the natural world gives the impression of having been designed for a purpose. But then he's going to go on and tell us why that's not the case. And an interesting facet of this argument to me is that he's saying our intuitions make it seem like we were designed for a purpose. But I'm going to use my intuitions to tell you that that's not true. So we kind of have a battle of intuitions here, and we're really close to another argument against evolution, which we might talk on about another day. All of that to say, DNA is information. Information is the product of a mind. Information does not come about randomly. In the same way that if you walked into the kitchen and saw spelled on the dining room table in Cheerios, "Hello, Mom," you're not going to think that happened randomly and without a purpose. You are going to rightfully understand that your child, instead of eating her food, spelled words with it, which, depending on her age, might be impressive and something you would celebrate. But all of that to say, that's information. That arrangement of Cheerios conveys something that's intelligible and achieves its purpose. It's a structured sort of thing in an intentional way. And that's information. Well, and that example came from Greg Kokel, just to give attribution there. But just to make the broader point, that's exactly what DNA is. So we have chunks of DNA that we understand that code for the creation of the eye. And that same chunk of DNA every time produces an eye when it's read and interpreted by the other natural processes and structures in the body. And so that is the information for the creation of an eye. That's what's contained in that DNA. And what we can actually see is an even greater level or layer of how that information works. So we've heard of genetics, right? That you have this genetic code and it codes for the creation of things. That's exactly what we've been talking about. But there's actually something called epigenetics. And what this talks about is how our genetic code actually gets expressed differently in different situations and in different environments. The same genetic code in one environment may actually create something a certain way, but in another environment may create it differently. But that's still coming from information. But I also think there's a beauty here we have to appreciate, that somehow that it just knows what to do in this other environment. What would we call something that just knew what to do in different circumstances and made the best choice in either one? That sounds like an intelligent sort of thing. Now, I'm not saying DNA is intelligent, but what I am saying is it's the result of intelligence. So when something responds accordingly in different situations, well, that's an intelligent type of thing. It's the product of a mind. But more than that, you know, it's interesting when we're talking about this epigenetic type of information and construct that some of the DNA that we used to think didn't do anything, you may have heard the term junk DNA, that there are just these sections that don't do anything. Well, what it actually seems like, some of these in different circumstances, in different situations and environments actually do different sorts of things. And that's where epigenetics comes into play. Now, I am not a geneticist, I'm not a biologist, I'm kind of an amateur in these things, and I'm trying to keep things simple for our purposes today. But what I hope you see is DNA is information, information comes from minds, epigenetics is actually a way where that same information gets expressed differently in different contexts, and that type of contextual awareness, once again, seems to be the product of a mind. It makes more sense that it was designed that way than if, it just randomly happened to do the right thing all the time in the right circumstances. That doesn't make as much sense. Now, this is an example of a type of situation where some people are going to say the evidence is compelling and others are going to say there's no evidence or the evidence is not compelling. And really what it comes down to is not is there evidence or is there not evidence, but what do my presuppositions dictate about how I will interpret the evidence? So some people are not going to agree with my conclusions here. That, for instance, epigenetics is the type of thing that's more explainable by the creation of a mind. And they're going to say that because they think naturalistic processes can account for that type of different genetic expression. But they're going to probably believe that because of their pre-commitment to naturalism, to this idea that there is not a supernatural, that there is not a creator. And so some people will say evolution is true, and you'll ask why, and they'll say, well, because naturalistic processes can totally explain how things came about. And you're like, well, but what about this idea that information is the creation of minds? And you're like, well, I don't think there is such a thing as a mind, or there's not a divine mind, so it had to be naturalistic. And so what you'll often find is that people are reasoning from the conclusion that there isn't a creator and using the evidence to support that. Now, I do think it's fair to point out Christians do the same thing in reverse oftentimes. We reason from the biblical worldview perspective that there is a creator, and that influences how we interpret the evidence. So, and I don't think we should reason differently than that, right? God has given us a worldview, a set of presuppositions. In 1 Peter 3:15, we're told to do apologetics, defending the faith under the lordship of Christ. And that includes reasoning from a Christ-centered worldview. However, the question becomes when we're talking with a non-Christian, let's put all the facts on the table and ask the question, does your worldview make this seem more reasonable, or does my worldview? Which makes the evidence seem more probable and plausible? Which is the best explanation? Which set of presuppositions? So, I certainly think that it makes more sense that this very complicated process that has created a diversity and a beauty of life is the result of a mind. Because in part, information comes from minds. But more than that, I see nothing that on its own gets more complicated without the infusion of information. So what we see in the fossil record is this period called the Cambrian Explosion, where the majority of the types of organisms that exist today all came into existence within about a 50 million year period, which is remarkably short of a period for evolution to be true. In fact, this is a great argument against evolution, that there was such a new diversity and explosion of life, which is why we call it the Cambrian Explosion, that this couldn't be accounted for by small successive changes over time. Because what we see there is an infusion of information. In the Cambrian explosion, there was a large infusion of new genetic information, and that's why we see new types of organisms. The organisms are a product of the information that coded for them, which is the creation of a mind. But that's compelling to me because of reasoning from a biblical worldview. You have a much harder time explaining that from a non-biblical worldview. So this is a place where the biblical worldview and explanation makes much more sense of the evidence. And so, to wrap this up, we've looked at a lot and we've looked at it briefly, but I just kind of want to plant some seeds so you're thinking about these types of ideas. And so, remember, information is the product of a mind. Genetic material, DNA, is information. It's a structured sort of thing. It's a particularly ordered type of thing that creates something else. It's information. And that information is even expressed and kind of interpreted differently in different circumstances via this process of epigenetics, such that some things we used to think were junk DNA actually aren't. And more than that, when we talk about these types of things, like the Cambrian explosion and this genetic explosion of information onto the scene, non-Christians aren't necessarily going to find that to be compelling on its own, or on the face of it. And that has to do with their presuppositions. We need to be comfortable with that type of reaction and anticipate it and not think, well, did I do it wrong? Or worse yet, some people will actually respond to that by saying, well, I guess there isn't evidence that God created everything. No, the issue is that we interpret the evidence differently. And so, once again, we need to encourage the non-Christian, just perhaps for the sake of argument, to step into our shoes, to look at the evidence through our worldview, with our set of assumptions and presuppositions, and say, does that make more sense of it? And it does. And every example of this type of situation we could come up with, when we're looking at the evidence from a non-Christian point of view or a Christian point of view, the Christian point of view has more explanatory power and makes more sense. Now, yes, it often requires adopting other beliefs and practices I don't like that confront my sense of autonomy. But nonetheless, that doesn't make it not true. And what we should encourage people to do is say, be intellectually honest enough to look at the facts, reason from them, and follow the conclusion wherever it takes you. And don't do that with regards to what change this must reflect in your life. Now, some people are very aware that if you start looking at the evidence this way and you go with the most reasonable conclusion, which is that God exists and created everything, that has overtones and conclusions they don't like. And so some scientists have even said, we can't allow God to get a divine foot in the door, because if we admit that the best explanation is that God created everything, well, that's probably going to screw with how I live, right? Following Jesus is going to affect your life. It's going to be inconvenient, to say the least. It's going to require a total orientation change of taking up your cross and following him. But all of that to say, we should encourage the non-Christian to take the evidence, consider it from a Christian point of view and from their point of view, and say, which is the best accounting for the evidence? Follow it wherever it leads and be intellectually honest enough with yourself and with me to not just reject what seems to be the explanation that makes the most sense because you don't like where it leads. And Christians, we shouldn't do that either. Oftentimes, we come to conclusions because we like them or reject conclusions because we don't like them, and neither should be acceptable for, well, anyone, but especially the Christian. Well, I'll talk with you next week on Unapologetic.